Thank you very much and good night.
Thank you.
Pause now on our Campbell Playhouse presentation of Rebecca. In just a moment, we will resume the story. But first, here is my associate of long standing, Ernest Chappell, with an important message.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. The time was, and it was not so long ago, when chicken was a rare and special treat. What magic the words chicken for dinner conjured up in our young minds, and how we looked forward to these great events. With proud gusto, Father would dexterously separate wings and legs and then carve tender white slices from the breast, while each of us silently prayed to be granted his special favorite part. And then on the second day, there came another treat. The remaining meat and the carcass went into Mother's soup kettle to be simmered slowly, seasoned gently, and served forth as a suppertime delight. Today, if you have wistful memories of that glorious old home chicken soup, then Campbell's Chicken Soup is just made for you. Because Campbell's chefs follow faithfully the good home recipe, only changing it to make an even better soup. They use, for example, all the good meat of the chickens, fine plump chickens they are too, such as you'd choose proudly for your own table. Such chicken soup with snowy rice and tender chicken pieces is a special treat indeed, but one you may enjoy on any day. Your grocer has Campbell's Chicken Soup, and it's yours for the asking. Remember, Campbell's Chicken Soup.
Now we return to the Campbell Playhouse presentation of Rebecca with Margaret Sullivan and Orson Welles.
Rouge.
Hello, I'm William English, and you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. You've just been listening to a couple of early tracks by Henri Chopin from 1956 and 1963. Last week I was talking to Ed Baxter, Programming Director for Resonance, and this week's guest is the Programming Director for Resonance, Ed Baxter. Last week we had a sort of sudden dash to the finishing line, so it seemed right to try and carry on where we left off. So thank you very much for coming back on, Ed.
Thank you, William. Sorry I'm late. I was caught on a tube train.
You were caught on a tube train?
Yes. Not evading my fares, just caught in the sense of suspended on a tube train.
Okay, not to worry. We'll have to just speed up a bit.
Talk quicker.
We'll talk quicker,
we'll
exactly.
We'll go on next week, forever and ever.
Okay. Well, it could do, actually. It could be quite interesting. Sort of.
Could be a new show.
Yeah, a whole epic, The Life and Times of Ed Baxter.
Yes.
Okay. Well, towards the end of last week's program, you described a performance you did as part of Gustav Metzger's self-cancellation event at Beaconsfield, in which you allowed yourself to be pelted with eggs while standing on a chair semi-naked. Earlier in that interview, you described yourself when you were a much younger man as being somewhat pretentious and later as a nasty piece of work. You seem to be very hard on yourself. Was the performance perhaps some sort of self-inflicted punishment?
Probably, yes. I think there's kind of a masochistic element to all these things.
Yep.
And a lot of me, if I can identify my identity, didn't really want to do it. I don't really like performing. I very rarely perform. Nobody else knew I was going to do that performance, so I could have not even mentioned it and nobody would have been any the wiser. But something inside me compelled me to go through with it, to find out what would happen. But really, in terms of my temperament, it's like putting a hand in a fire or something.
Really? Okay.
Not something I like to do.
Right. Do you suffer from stage fright? Or?
I don't anymore, because I was obliged by circumstance to do the announcements at the LMC concerts and festivals, because nobody else would do them. And I eventually got to the point where I couldn't care less about them, in a sense. So I don't really suffer from that kind of stage fright.
So you got over it? You sort of forced yourself through it?
Well, I put up with it, yeah.
Right. I was going to say, because I was actually going to lead on to that. I mean, I saw your role in the LMC as a sort of, almost like a sort of ringmaster. You were kind of...
You're too kind.
I mean, what actually was your position in the LMC? What was your kind of...
I was a concert producer, mainly, is
right.
What I did. But I think I introduced the concerts because at a certain point, I think I didn't trust anybody else to do it properly.
Okay.
So a bit of arrogance and a kind of give me that attitude in a lot of things I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you were good at it. I mean, you were very good at presenting. I mean, you have an air of authority, I suppose.
I'm told that. I don't really feel that. I find the sound of my own voice quite boring. I think on radio I'm not a very good interviewer, certainly, because my voice kind of drones on, and I tend to have lots of pauses in between the
words. Well, I haven't noticed anything yet.
No, that's because I'm talking to you, and I'm trying to do a monologue. Uh-huh. To a tape recorder, for example, there are long gaps in which you can hear my mind thinking anything. Good God, go and get on with it.
All right. So was it, would you say it was a political choice to join the idea of a collective, the LMC?
No, not for me. My politics were kind of well organized by that time, and in fact I suppose my attitude towards the collective was one of impatience and autocratic maneuvering to a large extent
on your part.
Yes, I think so. Whether consciously or not, it'd be very difficult to argue with the observation that lots of people have made over the last 17 years or so, that in fact I kind of pushed lots of other people aside in the interest of getting things done. And
that's probably always a problem, isn't it, with cooperatives and collectives?
Well,
in order to get things done efficiently, you have to sort of...
I'm not very interested in meetings. I think they're extremely antisocial and unproductive ways of transacting yourself. And in fact, every meeting would end with people being assigned tasks, and you either did them or you didn't. So it made sense to me to just do the tasks without too much discussion. And for everybody involved in the project, probably from the word go, there was always a sense that if you screwed up, made a mess of things, it didn't matter too much. So you could take quite a lot of risks, which when I was involved with the concert organisations, we took lots of risks, both mostly financial, but also artistically. And they, for a while, they seemed to pay off. So, but in terms of politics, I don't know. I was doing things like running a stall at the Anarchist Book Fair in the same period, and remember voting for the communist candidate in 1980, because I thought Ken Livingstone wasn't left-wing enough.
Right.
It depends what you mean by politics, I suppose.
Yes. Well, I was going to say, has your political stance changed over the last 10 years, if ever there was a defined stance as such?
Well, it has, to the point where the last time I was at the Anarchist Book Fair, not only was I bored witless by everybody else there, with the exceptions of the couple who organise it, who are sort of saint-like figures. Mm. But when a riot broke out on the Holloway Road, I found myself cowering behind my boxes of books with my pockets full of money, praying for a minicab. And I thought, well, this is some kind of change. And
would you have joined in at one point then?
Well, theoretically I might have done, but I think...
You can't join in a riot theoretically.
Well, no, I mean, in principle. But I think by then, the idea of lobbing bombs at people had become extremely unfashionable and revealed itself as a puerile posture. And a lot of that scene is about puerile posturing, and some of it's very funny. Class war, I think, are kind of satirical wits. Others, the chaps associated with the Freedom Bookshop, for example, I fear posers whose pose has stuck would be a not too unfair comment, but I would apply that to myself at that period of my life as well, I think. The pose came unstuck out of restlessness. I wasn't really that interested.
So, are we all political chameleons now?
Well, I don't know. I think with the radio station, my politics kind of find an outlet in that I think it's a very constructive social project, and I feel rather than being a chameleon, I like to be somebody who doesn't leave too deep a footprint. So it's a matter of not really having an attitude and letting other people have the attitudes. So maybe I'm just lazy now. Maybe I'm just
so. Do you see yourself as an enabler, as it were? In this,
well, that's what I do. Yes. Whether I see myself as that, I don't know. I'm a faceless bureaucrat, really.
I don't nowadays. Think so. Yeah. I wouldn't agree with that. But anyway, in Resonance magazine, Retuning Radio. There was a piece about radio art in contemporary Germany by Sabine Breitsameter, is it? Breitsameter, about the Neue Hörspiel, where contemporary radio art in Germany identified itself as anti-establishment. However, the anti-position had run out of steam. Being avant-garde had lost its socio-critical impetus and any political pertinence it might once have had.
And
I know it's not so much a question as a statement. And that was the 1970s. But does that apply today? I mean, do you think, does Resonance basically have any socio-critical impetus?
Well, I got an email from somebody at Transmission Gallery asking me to work with them entirely on the grounds that by being a kind of self-organized project, Resonance was necessarily oppositional. I could see where they were coming from, but I found myself also simultaneously, perversely, being opposed to their language, which struck me as incredibly long-winded, bureaucratic, kind of arts world equivalent of Bert speak. And I'm not sure.
Well, that's interesting because
I'm qualified to comment on the avant-garde, because the avant-garde currently is whatever people in their early 20s are doing in little squats in Peckham and so forth, and probably in their bedrooms, rather than, it's certainly not the still so-called YBAs, for example. And I don't know where the avant-garde in contemporary music exists, but it's absolutely definitely not among the corridors of the Society for the Promotion of New Music, for example. I suspect it is in very small venues mostly in North London.
Mm-hmm.
But I fear that I am very remote from those areas of activity, and my role in the radio station is to be this person who experiences life by proxy and through other people.
But don't you think Resonance should perhaps be in connection with that avant-garde somehow, if it exists at all?
Well, it probably should be, but that's a matter of people actually making that happen rather than anybody willing connections into being. I don't think you can force these things.
No.
And in fact, I think some of the broadcasters themselves represent an avant-garde, and some of the things we broadcast are definitely avant-garde. But there's not a kind of coherent policy, or I don't think there's really a coherent avant-garde. I think there's a lot of fallout from postmodernism, and I think most of it is still, sadly, pretty wrapped up in a late Thatcherite attitude towards swapping your place in history for a place in the country, or getting both if you possibly can. Mm. And as somebody who's always been very bad at earning money, I've never really been motivated by that idea that you should somehow make a killing out of correct politics and have everybody like you.
Hmm.
Does that answer the question? I forget. Not really. The avant-garde should always be running away.
Well, I think I started by asking whether resonance was, I suppose, in touch with what you might call this, or is it right that it should be detached from what might be an avant-garde existing in squats in North London?
I think resonance has its avant-garde and its conservatives, probably, that it's microcosmic in that sense. I think we try and push it one way or another, but you can only try to form a critical mass of, you know, a centre of meaning, and things spin off from that. And people, for example, with the music programming, part of me would like lots of extreme din 24 hours a day, but
such as
most of
any examples.
Oh, I wouldn't mind the
contemporary din, is it?
Yeah, you know, kind of stuff we did on the feedback order from Noise Tour, for example. Mm-hmm. But the general listener, perhaps, and certainly the bulk of the music broadcasters tend inevitably to gravitate towards melodic music, and you can't really tell them off for that or say that we should be following orthodoxy, because I think that's not really part of what we do. I think the editorial part of resonance is very light and hands off. I don't really like other broadcast mechanisms that are dripping with editorial goo and which are over-policed.
Mm.
It's a strange buzzing noise.
There is, isn't there? Yes.
Is it because you've got the faders up too high?
I have no idea. There's a slight creak from the chair as well. I think it's always there when it's quiet. When it goes sort of quiet, you hear this buzz. But
that's
all right.
The avant-garde.
Yeah,
that's the wind of change. William.
Okay. Oh my God, we are rapidly approaching that time again. I can't believe it. I was just sort of relaxing then, thinking,
"Can we cancel the next program? Aren't I allowed to do that?"
Well, as programming director, you are well within your rights to do whatever you want.
What's on? Does anyone know?
This will be a first.
Well, I don't know. Maybe you could find out.
Well, we'll just carry on, and then we could always carry on another time. If not,
to go and find out. Otherwise, we've got a minute to find out.
We've got a minute. In this last minute, which might be the last minute or might not, do you want to say anything about the funding of Resonance? Forever fated to skate on thin ice, or will it sort of ever have a solid foundation?
Well, I'm trying to organise an auction of artworks at the moment for the autumn, which would maybe raise enough money to last 2 or 3 years, enable us to free up time to raise other money. But, yeah, funding is always difficult because the station appears in the world as something that's free. You just turn on your radio and there it is. Sounds like it's functioning. Nobody knows out there that it's whether it's held together with string or rope. And people are generally bored to the back teeth with discussions of funding, including me. I personally, of course, I think that this is good. That on this computer screen next to us, there's a huge
something's getting bigger and bigger, isn't
saying
it?
Saying that Cecilia Wee is on. So on that bombshell, we'll have to leave it.
All right.
Until next week.
Another time. Thank you very much, Ed Baxter, for coming on again. You've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM.
This is Resonance FM. My name's Cecilia Wee, and you're listening to the third part of Art and War, Series 2. My five-part series exploring representations and cultural understandings of war and militarised combat. It is perhaps obvious to state that collective awareness about war and its related concepts has become increasingly acute since the declaration of war on terror. Within such a climate, traditional notions of propaganda as constructed by the state to raise national support for a war have been somewhat destabilised by the plethora of media channels. Today, states, non-state agents, individuals and organisations equipped with the tangible means of disseminating opinions are able to participate in influencing the public in ways that were previously inaccessible. My show this week looks at an older instance of propaganda, war posters. I visited the Imperial War Museum's current exhibition, Weapons of Mass Communication, and spoke to curator Richard Slocum. So here we are at the Imperial War Museum's Weapons of Mass Communication exhibition. I'm here with Richard Slocum, senior curator, and you're the co-curator of this exhibition.
Yes.
It's an exhibition of war posters collected by the Imperial War Museum.
Yes, that's right.
Since how long?
Since 1917, since the founding of the museum. The importance of propaganda was recognised very early on by the museum. And the poster collection was started in 1917 by a chap called Lawrence Bradley, who went on to become the Director General. Lawrence Bradley really collected posters